So hello, everyone. Welcome to a very fun episode, I believe, of Movie Madness with me, your host, Khalil Jamal. I'm joined by the creator of one of my all-time favorite TV shows, really, and one of my childhood favorite TV shows, the creator of Detentionaire, Charles Johnson. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's the 10-year anniversary of the end of your show, and, you know, it was very... You know, it was one of the shows, which was the first time I actually, like, watched something week to week. And it was, like, it was a very fun show just because of how it was done. And so I'm very excited to talk about it. Got some questions from the very active Detentionaire subreddit in here as well. So, you know, it's going to be a mixture of things.
Right on. Bring it on.
So let's talk about how the show ended. And we'll talk about the actual ending eventually. But I want to know kind of when did you find out that the show was being canceled? Did you find out kind of when you were making the last season? Did you find out kind of toward the end of making it? Like, how did that process kind of unfold?
Yeah, from what I can recall, we were recording the last few episodes where you know, we record the audio and then it takes a really long time, you know, for the animation to catch up to it. But I seem to remember that it was the last couple episodes we were in voice records for, and we got word from the production company that they weren't going to continue the show because they hadn't made a U.S. sale. And so there just wasn't enough incentive for the production company to continue. It just wasn't really looked at as a moneymaker ultimately. And we were kind of stuck because we had left the season on a cliffhanger because we were hoping to keep going. And we were, yeah, like I say, we were in the record, actually recording the last couple episodes. So it was sort of like, it really felt like too late to change. And I remember the broadcaster and the local broadcaster Teletoon, where they loved the show. They were getting a lot of great feedback on it. And I remember having a call when we were at the voice record, because they said, "What's this news about the show not continuing?" And it was like they were asking us, "Why aren't you going to continue this?" And we were like, "We want to, but we've been told it ain't happening." So it was disappointing for us and very disappointing for people watching, because I definitely heard a lot about it. And it was sort of posed to us as if, like, why did you do this? Which I totally understand. And if I could go back in time, because we did try to wrap it up in the last couple episodes, like a lot of the mysteries, we tried to kind of go, this is the answer and this is kind of what's going on. But it was that opening things up again to like a whole new sort of chapter that really, left people a little cold.
Well, and I will say, and that's why the reason I wanted to ask you is because in preparation for this, actually, I was going to just watch like a few episodes from each season. I ended up binging the entire show because it's just, I forgot how amazing it was. But what I realized was the last season cliffhanger was not nearly as big of a cliffhanger as we'd previously seen. So I wasn't sure if that was something that you had made changes to because it did. Again, it felt like something which felt a lot more like, yeah, if it kind of continues, then we'll talk about this. But if not, it kind of gave you enough of an ending where you're not kind of like, you know, angrily wanting to know how it ends in that same way.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. A lot of stuff I watched when I was younger, you know, there were literally shows I would watch on TV where, you know, it would be like to be continued with a question mark. Right. It was always like there were so many like horror movies, you know, where the final images that you're left with is like, oh, this isn't over. And so, I mean, it was kind of in the spirit of that. But we did. And I'll be honest, we didn't know exactly where we were going to go. But we always sort of tried to leave the end of seasons with enough of a cliffhanger for ourselves to kind of go, okay, we've painted ourselves into this corner. How do we get out of it? Which we found very, creatively fulfilling. I don't always recommend it, especially nowadays, people are just way too savvy, you know, but we did it as kind of a creative exercise for ourselves. We found that the most fun is like set up something exciting and then try to explain it. So that's kind of an explanation of sort of like how all that happened.
So when you look at a show like Detentionaire, right? And it's a show which I think does something really well and very, And it's very unique in how it does this, because you see a lot of shows now try to replicate this kind of style of telling a mystery, right? Where they end up, you see the show kind of, like, when you see it kind of replicated, you see it kind of step on itself. And you see people, like, you know, try to take things to the extremes, or, you know, kind of create new twists. Detention Era never felt like that. It never felt like a show where it was like, oh, they're just trying to one-up themselves, or they're just trying to do this for the sake of, you know, surprising people. How did you unravel this story basically so perfectly that it never felt, even when you got to the final season, which I would argue is probably the kind of peak level of absurdity the entire show had, how do you never get to a point where it feels like, oh my God, this is, they've just kind of like, they're just kind of going crazy now?
Yeah, I don't know. I appreciate that, because, I mean, in some ways, you know, it really was, you know, we were taking some pretty big swings. So it's really nice to hear that that you know, things landed, because I think that when we were first doing the series, like in the first couple seasons, we were like, okay, it's just a mystery within the school that we have to solve. And then there was, at the time, Lost was this really big show on TV. And we noticed with that, week after week, the mystery kept getting bigger, and we were sort of inspired by that. And it was like, it just hit us one day where we were like, if this is going to continue, what if the mystery keeps going outside of the school? And it just sort of became almost limitless, and it allowed us to say a lot of things about where we thought the world was going in terms of, you know, big companies kind of, you know, controlling everything, and what the, where they go to create like this super elite kind of vibe for, you know, people that are rich enough or whatever. We just started kind of going, okay, these kids are really banding together against this tyrannical force coming at them. And we, you know, that was the thing with, if the show had continued, we would have just kept going bigger and bigger and bigger. And as we were sort of going sort of beyond the boundaries, we were also digging deeper and deeper personally into, you know, real childhood memories, like high school memories that we had. And I know the whole fourth season, the whole thing about the brother, I found out late in life that I had a brother that I never knew about. And he, you know, I got to grow up with our father, and he never knew him. And you know, that was some pretty heavy stuff. And it was really interesting to be able to go into that kind of stuff and put it into the show and sort of, it was that idea of like grounding things in reality, but allowing these fantastical sort of turns, as long as they're tethered to something real. I guess we were playing with that a lot. I mean, it got pretty wild at the end with Coral Grove and everything. You know, we were definitely pushing it pretty far, but you know, I give my partner, Dan Franklin, a lot of credit for just like, he has this incredible way of going really far out, but making it feel real in a way.
And I think part of what did that is you have, you know, you're right. You do have the Coral Grove stuff, which is, you know, a little bit crazy, but then you have Li Ping trying to find his mother, right? And you have, you know, Li Ping trying to find, you know, various people he cares about. Like there's still those connections, right? Those human level dynamics, which are never lost, which I think personally really, you know, it kind of grounds the show, like you're saying. And I think it's, I love the show, so I'm never going to be critical of it, but I think it really does a great job with that, like with doing both those things.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, and a lot of it too, we had a lot of fun creating the characters. But the casting was so inspired. The cast were so incredible, and they elevated the whole thing right away when we did the pilot. And they were coming in for these voice records, and we were talking about the characters with them. And it was one of those things where it's sort of like they brought it to life for us, and they gave us a lot more to work with, and gave us a lot more ideas just by being who they were and what they were bringing to the roles. And so then it became a very character-driven show, which is always the goal. It's just that sometimes you end up with a bunch of types as opposed to real dimensional characters. And yeah, we sort of, you know, we went after something, and what we also got lucky too. You know, it was a very collaborative effort. A lot of people contributed a lot to the show. And so it became this kind of creative soup. You know, that, I mean, just kept us going. I mean, we had a blast doing it.
So one of that, so that kind of leads me to another question, which is when you look at these characters and really the high school experience, which outside of the the supernatural elements, is a pretty like accurate one, more so than you get from a lot of shows, especially now. And so how much of that were, how many of these characters were kind of based on your own life or on the life of the cast, and how much of it, and how much of the actual experience was, and the story was based on kind of real events or part or partial real events, I guess.
Yeah, I guess we really did let ourselves go. I mean, I know that Dan and I, we've always collaborated creatively really well, because we used to work together years ago on some other things. And we used to do this thing where we would just kind of walk around and talk, and just, and it was always this thing about let your mind go. Just like, don't hold yourself back at all. And we also did put a lot of, so we'd have fun. It was very playful, but we based a lot of stuff on real things. It's like right from the get-go, it's like the relationship that Lee had with his mom was kind of based on the relationship that Dan had with his mom. And some of the characters, I mean, I went to an international boarding school in Singapore, and there was literally a guy named Holger. I mean, it's like, it's in some cases, I'm not even changing the name, you know, it's like, that's who that guy was to me. I could almost like go through everybody and say this was somebody in my life, you know, like Biffy was sort of like this guy that I worked with on TV sets when I first started in the business, when I was doing lighting. It was like there was this big, huge, tough guy that everyone was scared of, and he and I became friends. You know, it's just, and I did a lot of sneaking around in boarding school too. I was sneaking out all the time at night, and going out, and that kind of excitement of being able to kind of figure out the system and figure out how to exploit it and look for loopholes. I mean, it just became second nature to me. So I found that part of the show really, really cool too. So, I mean, it really was a mixed bag, but a lot of it was just creative fun, just really trying to say something, trying to do something different. Though I know we really wanted to make a show that wasn't like other shows, even if we were inspired by other shows.
So, now, just to kind of talk about Holger quickly, I got to ask this because Reddit wants to know. And after I read the question, I'm like, I want to know too. Was there ever a point where you're kind of thinking either in the future to make Holger kind of, you know, kind of a sleeper agent, or was he just meant to be comic relief? Like, or was there maybe in your mind at least thoughts of, hey, maybe he could be, you know, secretly evil, kind of the Jar Jar Binks conspiracy line of thinking?
Yeah, that's funny because that jogs a memory, because I guess I'd kind of forgotten this, but I know at one point we sort of asked ourselves, like, who is this guy and what's going on with him? And in our minds, it was like his dad was sort of like this international sort of like James Bond character. And Holger was kind of following in his dad's footsteps in a way. And we were sort of playing with the idea of like he really was a secret agent, or he really wanted to be, and the idea that that a lot of what he was doing was kind of put on, that a lot of the comic relief really was him trying to fit in with the school, that maybe he was a little older, because I mean he looked older than everyone else, right? I mean, we got some pushback from the network at one point, that we're just like, this, who is this man walking around with these kids, you know? And so a lot of it was that too. It's like we had to come up with an answer for that. So then, you know, if we did say something like, well, he's actually, we've got big plans for him down the road, then we could kind of get away with things. So again, kind of a mix.
So it was that Jar Jar Binks Sith Lord kind of angle for everything, which I actually love. So when you look at when did you kind of realize that you guys were going to go full Illuminati with the show, with the pyramid and the lizard people secretly running the world?
Yeah, I think it was, I feel like it was, we were hinting at it because we were basically just playing around with a lot of things that we'd seen in the 70s in conspiracy movies. Like the parallax view and stuff like that. There, you know, they were always hinting at, it was just such a big thing in the 70s that so many movies had that angle, that we were playing with it at first in a playful way. And then once we, in fourth season, we realized, well, we should really start explaining some of this stuff. So then we kind of went deeper into it, and we, instead of just being, you know, trying to be really coy and enigmatic about it. We were really trying to go, what is happening behind the scenes? And yeah, I mean, we took some swings there too. We weren't really trying to be too literal, but we were playing with that idea. It was more like that paranoid idea that it's like, what if? Rather than really, it doesn't really reflect how we see the world. But in some ways, sometimes you wonder, and just playing around with that sense of wonder.
Because I remember going to school after the, you know, season and the end of the show. And I remember I was trying to defend to one of my teachers the idea that lizard people ran the world. It was a time. So I'll tell you, that's right.
Yeah, it gets kind of, it's almost like, yeah, it gets borderline offensive, right? It's like where it's like, you know, people can make a lot of assumptions there. And it's like, no. I mean, it's a cartoon. I mean, it's like, we're not really trying to be that subversive, just a little subversive.
Well, I didn't understand it. Like, I just saw the lizard people and I was like, this is cool. I think this is how the world runs. And apparently that was not a popular belief, but it's okay, you know?
Yeah. I hear you. I totally hear you. Because it is, it's sort of like, you know, it's more, yeah, there's that movie They Live, you know, where it's sort of like, to me, it's hilarious. It's like, there's that idea that it's like, what if it really, what if this was happening? But ultimately, it's sort of, it is cartoon. Even that movie was kind of cartoony, you know, and it's fun. It's mostly just for fun.
So were there any character dynamics or, you know, kind of relationships, which you kind of feel like, damn, I would have wished we could have built on that, or I would have loved to see what we could have done with these two characters?
We explored it a lot as it was, and I think that's why we sort of brought new characters in, you know, like when the outcasts were sort of just a one-off episode early in the show, and then we could really, you know, brought them back and made Jenny Jergens like a, you know, much much bigger character for the show. I think that was because we had tried everything we wanted to try, and so we were bringing new characters in to see what that would kind of stir up. I mean, it's like, you mean in terms of like coupling up and stuff, or just seeing characters on their own?
Both. I mean, like, were there characters who you wanted to kind of see get a bigger role, or kind of relationships you wanted to develop?
Yeah, I mean, I think we really did the relationship stuff, and we were always playing with that idea. I mean, the Brandy and Camellia thing was something that we really didn't see at first, and then we were like, it would be so crazy if they got together. And it really excited us. And Chaz Monoranian is somebody who, like, I really loved that character and I would have loved to sort of explain more. But then at the same time, it's like, well, maybe you don't really want to, because he is really funny. And if you found out too much about him, it would probably be much less funny, right? I mean, it's like those kind of people in real life, you know, they're either hollow or they're kind of like the opposite of what they appear to be. And so, I don't know. I really do think that we maxed out a lot of stuff.
Now, again, I you know, the internet wants to know, and I know you've kind of talked about this before, but you do have to tell me, like, what your plan would have been for season five. I saw a quote when I was doing some research on it, that it was like some sort of like semi-sitcom vibe that you're planning. What was the kind of plan going forward?
Yeah, I guess because we had a few, it was sort of like we always had notions and we never had details until we would do this thing where, because Dan lived down in LA and I would fly down and we would walk on, you know, the Venice canals and on the beach for days. It would just walk around talking and everything would just bubble up and happen. And so a lot of times we didn't get too ahead of ourselves because we really found it fun to just go, we kind of have a vague idea. And I know that the way we kind of wanted to go after this was we had originally pitched the network that we wanted to have kind of a space angle. And they were disappointed at the time because they were like, oh, we have so many shows that have the final revelation is like, oh, it's aliens or whatever. And so they said, oh, please don't do that. And so right away we were like, well, we still want to do something like that. So instead of it being space, we'll go underground. And it's sort of like we called it, instead of upstairs, we'll go downstairs. And it was this idea that it was almost still kind of an alien angle. It was like some kind of like, we had this vague idea of like, you know, to like, you know, the earliest days of, you know, before human civilization almost, you know, that there were this, that there was sort of these creatures that had come to Earth and they had to hide under the Earth for some reason. And then this was the time they were going to come out, you know, just again, very vague. And so then that's why we had that final image of, you know, Thaddeus Mann coming up with all these things behind him. And what we sort of explained some of the stuff with the Tazzel worm, you know, sort of hinting at some of that stuff. And we were going to find the connective tissue for that later. And the sick, I know that that we had hopes of, because we were fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and we really, we kind of grew up watching that show, and we loved that idea of kind of like going to high school and then you're going to university at the same time that the characters in the show are going to university. And we kind of wanted to do that with Detentionaire if it kept going and going. We're just like, well, eventually they'll go to university and there'll be some kind of like roommate situation. And the, and I think that's when we were like, oh, it'll be almost like sitcom. Because whenever I think of like roommates, I think of like Three's Company or something, you know. So those are all sort of like pie in the sky vague notions that we were hoping to tie together if we got the chance. But I don't have too many details to divulge. I mean, you know, I'm not even, you know, holding them back. It's like we really just didn't get the chance.
Now, would there be anything when you look at the kind of run the show had, would there be anything you're like, looking back on it, I would have loved to change that, or I would have loved to go in a different direction and kind of see where it landed? I know you talked a little bit about aliens. Was there anything kind of, you know, early on where you're like, maybe we should have done this instead?
Yeah, I don't think so, because I think that we dug so deep a lot of the time and like really put a lot of our cards on the table. And it's like and then once we picked a direction, we just went with it. And it's like one of those things, almost like in life, sometimes you don't want to speculate too much about going back and taking another direction, because then you're like, well, then I wouldn't be exactly where I'm at right now, you know, and sort of a contentment of where things are. But I will say that there was, we had some problems with the production company owned the rights to the show, and we could never get the rights from them because it was a really early deal for Dan and I. And we had to sign that stuff away to make the show happen. And if we could have gotten the rights back, we had talked about doing a live action version of Detentionaire and starting from scratch. And that, I think if we did do that, we would have gone in other directions. Nothing that I can really speculate on now. It's just that I don't think we would have done it exactly the same way, because that's just boring. So I think we would have taken the same premise and had different things happen, or at least different things you see, like the things that were off screen and, you know, in the animated version, maybe we would focus on or something like that.
So, you know, it's interesting about what you just said. And I didn't expect to go this way, but I really want to talk about this because I was watching the Avatar, The Last Airbender Netflix show. Right. And it's meant to be a remake of the original animated show. It's exactly the same, essentially. It's kind of like a lazier version, if we're being honest, of that same show. And I was thinking, I was like, why, when people do live action remakes, do they not kind of make different, they have different twists, kind of change things up a little bit? Because you do see this often where you have these remakes, which are basically just their attempts to carbon copy, but with real people instead of animated characters. I'm like, if you want the story that happened there, just go watch the animated one. So what is your kind of view on that kind of dynamic in Hollywood especially?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've sort of had that my whole life because I, you know, I've read so many books that have become movies, and it's like, you know, that I know that sometimes you love something so much that you don't want it to change if it's adapted. But I almost think that that's sort of, I don't know. I don't think that's ultimately the way you should view things. I think that the whole point of adaptation is like, what can we do differently if we're going to bother doing this in a different format? How do we take advantage of that and do something exciting and unique? And I think that sometimes because people sometimes get upset when a, you know, book changes too much when it's adapted into a movie, then I think sometimes, you know, less creative executives will say, oh, well, let's just give the audience exactly what they want. And it gets confusing because it's like, but that may be what they want, but it's not what they need. And it's like, you have to You know, you have to take bigger risks and say, trust us, we're going to show you something different. And at some of, you know, there are definitely movies I've seen that I thought were superior to the book because they had a chance of realizing it further. And I just think that creatively that's much more exciting. I think it's just a kind of a cynical money grab to just go, we're just going to do it again. Exactly beat for beat the same way. It's just not right.
And by the way, I think I don't know if you've seen Fargo, the movie and the show, but I think both of those are prime examples of how you can do things differently and still keep kind of the same concepts when you're kind of trying to remake things for different mediums.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Especially like the very latest season of Fargo. Because I've been watching every single season, and this last season reminds me so much of the movie. But it's almost like the spirit of it is the same, but not the details. You know, it's just too interesting. You know, it's just a different vision of sort of the same world as opposed to just a carbon copy, as you put it.
So, when the season one was coming out, and I'm sure you saw it, the internet was full of speculation on who Rad Circles was, who, you know, was framing Lee. Like, you saw all this stuff, I'm sure. Was there any, like, did you see any comments? Like, I know there was a Teletoon poll at the time asking who framed Lee. Was there any, like, anyone you saw where you're like, wow, that, I don't know how they got to that point. I don't know how people can think it was this person, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I don't actually remember that too specifically, because I think we were scanning it so that we could think harder about stuff and be more surprising. But I tried not to get too caught up in anything, because then I might creatively just start going in that direction or something. But I know it was difficult to, because we didn't know. I mean, when we did the pilot, we didn't know what happened. And it was like it was sort of like watching the pilot, how it all sort of came together, that we would sort of watch like those flash images in the gym and kind of imagine for ourselves who could be doing what. And, you know, a lot of the first few episodes were like, oh, you know, well we, you know, the skaters had probably had something to do with it. And then we started that idea of like that it was a Rube Goldberg kind of thing, that there were so many people involved. And so in a sense, you could almost have your cake and eat it too, because it's like if someone said, oh, I think it was the skaters, then it's sort of like, well, yeah, they had a part in it. I think the whole like coming up with the Lynch character, you know, was basically, you know, in some ways kind of a cheat, because we were like, well, no one really knew who that was originally, and so we were sort of introducing that person. And I think for us, when we kept kind of like realizing the show and conceiving it further and watching it, we just started to really see that VP Victoria, in some ways was kind of the slyest kind of person in the background that sort of seemed like she was nice. And, I mean, yeah, we, you know, Dan and I have seen a lot of murder mysteries, and it's a balancing act, because it's like, you don't want to be obvious, but you don't want to be too obscure. And in some ways you kind of want it to be that thing that's right there all the time, right in front of you, and you just maybe didn't notice it. So we were trying to have it all. It's sort of like bringing someone new to the table, having someone there that was always there, and then having everyone have a piece in a sense, like they were set up to be involved.
Yeah, it was interesting, because I love the way you dealt with characters like Barrage, where, you know, you kind of made them at the beginning seem like they were, you know, evil to some extent. I mean, being a cyborg probably, you know, helped that image a lot, but then having him being controlled, right? And then him not being that bad of a guy, even though he was still very strict, right? Like, you had those kind of, you had ways of kind of making characters good without making them good. And I thought that was very effective, especially to making sure things weren't super obscure.
Right. Yeah. Cool. I mean, a lot of it is inspired, you know, we were inspired by things that we grew up loving, and things that we noticed about movies and TV shows that we liked. And that was one of it too, is just like that. And even in life, you know, it's like one of my favorite, you know, character development things is in life is when you meet somebody you don't like and then you end up loving them later on, or, you know, or vice versa. It's interesting. People peeling the layers, like everyone's an onion, right? It's like, it's in life, and it's fun to explore that in creative endeavors.
Now, when you look at the Mr. Worst's characters, the clones, how early on did you kind of figure that they were going to be clones, right? Like, was that an early on decision, or was that kind of, you know, when they kind of were revealed to be clones?
Yeah, I think it was, if I remember correctly, that I think the first thing that we thought of is, we were like, what if this was like this elite school? It was almost in disguise. It wasn't obvious it was an elite school. But we started kind of peppering in this idea that that teachers were actual historical figures. And I think we tried to make it funny at first. It's like, oh, that guy looks like Ben Franklin. And then we were just sort of like, well, no, what if it really was? And then it was like, well, how would you do that? And it was like, well, cloning technology, and just, you know, and then we just, it was like, once we, there was a really funny thing too, is that in the writer's room, there was this one writer who would always tell us, you can't do that. And for some reason, we were just sort of, we were kind of brats in a way. But I think it was all, you know, all good in the long run. But whenever she would say, you can't do that, we would say, yes, we can. And we're going to double and triple down on it, because it's like, if it makes you uncomfortable, like, we're going to go nuts with it. And I do think that the cloning thing was like, take it easy, take it easy. I think a lot of people were like, take it easy with this, it's getting a little unwieldy. And then we just went nuts. I mean, it's all so bizarre. Like the eating of the dried pasta and everything. I mean, it's like, when I think back on all that stuff, it's like, we were just going for it full throttle.
So when you look at, I want to find the exact wording of a question, because it really underscores the point. It was about Kimmy's family. Oh, here it is. So one of the main problems that this person had was the explanation of Cassandra's family. Her brother seems to be of different ethnicity. Kimmy doesn't have the mark. Was there kind of, like, what was the plan with Cassandra's family? And was there, I guess, reasons for some of those things?
Maybe it kind of says it all that I don't remember clearly enough to be able to explain that. And so, you know, sometimes you can find flaws in things, right? And you can poke at it. And, you know, a lot of times with creative stuff, you try to make it bulletproof so that if somebody does poke at it, you're like, no, we got it all covered. But I mean, I will admit that, you know, because just as you ask me that, I'm like, wow, I barely remember that. But I do remember there was that thing about the mark. Some people had it, some people didn't. And I'm not even convinced that we really 100% had that sorted, that maybe it was one of those things. We had so many things in play. And, you know, it's almost like the show caught up to us in a way where we were always trying to figure stuff out on the fly, and it was fun. And it's like, that's where it's sort of like when I was saying earlier that you have to be a little savvier now. Like, people are so media savvy that they can find every detail and go, this doesn't track. And I find that shows are more sophisticated now, where you're like, wow, everything actually pays off. And I think at the time we were doing this, it was sort of, it was even new, just to the fact that we had a show, a cartoon, that would end on a cliffhanger, and then the next episode would have like a previously on. That was a big, big deal that we were even getting away with that, because no one ever wanted to do that. They were always like, cartoons have to be self-contained, that they can be played out of order. And we really, really pushed for, let's make a show like some of the shows like Lost that adults were loving. Let's give, you know, the younger generation those kind of shows that you can really get invested in. And so, you know, it was all very new. And, you know, it was like winning the lottery to even get this show picked up. And I think we had a lot of fun with it, and we did our best. But I, you know, I'll be the first to admit that there are holes, and I can't explain everything.
So how would this show continue? Has there been, you know, over the course, since it's ended, have there been conversations about, you know, a potential way this could continue, even if it's out of TV, in terms of, like, you know, a graphic novel or something else? I know you talked about a live action show, at least in your mind, kind of existing. was there anything else? Like, have there been other conversations?
Yeah, the live action thing I talked about, and I know that when the show was still on, I remember one time we had a meeting with sort of like investors and all this stuff, and I remember there was someone that was representing sort of the graphic novel world that was there, and it just didn't follow through because it was near the end, and we were pretty excited about the idea of doing a graphic novel, but once the show ended, the rights got tied up, and it's the kind of thing where it's almost like you know the show had some success and is having a bit more now, maybe in sort of being sort of rediscovered, and it's sometimes companies don't want to give the rights away, so that just in case you go off and you make something really, really extra cool, I guess. And so it's sort of like it's this control, it's a bit of a power game, and we just can't get the rights to do anything else with it. I mean, at one point we were like, oh, it'd be such a cool video game. You know, there's lots of things we could have done. And I think if we were doing it now, it would be different because there's, you know, a lot of stuff I'm involved with development of now. I mean, we're thinking about all those possibilities really early on. It's like, what are all of the possible, you know, cross-media things that we can do with this? And let's do it early. It was such an experiment, I think, that show. And in some cases, I think the production company didn't really even know what they had. They appreciated that it was new and exciting, but maybe they didn't exploit it as well as they could have.
So I don't know if you're allowed to say this, but do you know who has the rights? Like, which company has the rights right now?
Yeah, I mean, I believe it's Chorus. Like, when we... that was another thing, is that when we were pitching the show, when we were first sort of, it was being shepherded and we were developing it, it was with Nelvana, and they were in the process of being absorbed by Chorus. And I think that's part of the complication as well, is when the show was greenlit, like, we started at the Nelvana office, like in Liberty Village in Toronto. And by the time the show really got going, by episode 5, when we were conceiving it, I remember we were at Nelvana, and then by episode 10, I remember we were at Chorus, because it was just like we're in this huge building, in these huge writers' rooms, as opposed to the smaller, more intimate kind of setting. This building had like a slide that people could ride at the end of their workday, down to the lobby, and foosball tables everywhere. I mean, it was wild how big it was. And I guess, think that's part of where things are going now, right? It's a lot of companies, small companies get eaten up by the bigger companies, and they just become so big that things get a little bit, things can get lost in the shuffle a lot easier, right? Because you're not really putting enough focus on a few things that you have. You have so many things that it's almost just like, you sort of just go, well, is this a huge hit or not? And if it's not, well, then let's move on.
So what you're telling the audience is, if you really want the show back, the people you have to talk to are the people at Chorus.
I think so. But it's one of those things, it's almost a little bit like Detention Aaron itself, is we got to the point where we didn't know what was going on. Like, when we would ask for certain things that there was some resistance to, we'd be like, well, who can we talk to? And it was always a little bit murky. It was always sort of like, well, the people on the top floor. And it's like, well, who are they? Can we go up there? And it's like, it's sort of mysterious. It just got to a point where we really didn't know, is the my most honest answer.
Okay, so now people know they have a way to start if they really want the show back. Maybe we'll find a way to get someone from Chorus on the podcast, and I can grill them on Detention Air.
Sure.
So Lynch loved Knock Knock jokes, obviously. Was there an inspiration for that, or was that just kind of like was there someone who you knew in your own life who you kind of saw Lynch as and took the Knock Knock joke thing from?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember now, because I remember when we were sort of conceiving the character, and we were sort of like this idea of the, again, like almost like a darker version of Holger. It's sort of like this man who's sort of hiding amongst the kids at school. And, and it's like, I think we named him after David Lynch, and we were putting a lot of sort of ideas into one place. And I remember wanting him to sound like Don Knotts. And we actually got an actor that was like, sure, I can do that. And he sort of did this like Jimmy Stewart, Don Knotts hybrid. We were playing around with that too. And the idea of sort of like creating a villain and, you know, and the idea that it's sort of like the creepier villains sometimes are just so odd. And I think we were trying to come up with something that, you know, a knock knock joke seems so innocuous, and it seems like only like, you know, kids in kindergarten and first grade really like knock knock jokes. It would be so weird if an adult was saying them all the time. And that's just that idea of the creepiness of like the knock knock on your door and who is it. It's just, yeah, I mean, you know, it's just things like that. I think it was one of those things where it came, it sort of popped up, and then we realized it was just so weird that we went again, we took this idea and ran with it and did as much as we could with it.
Because I don't know why, but my naive kid brain when I first watched show, and I remember this, was I was always convinced that Lynch was the Riddler from Batman, because it just, there were so many similarities, like how the Riddler was animated in a lot of the cartoon, in the, a lot of the Batman cartoons. And I was like, and even the way he spoke and all this, I was like, again, you know, my naive kid brain not understanding how rights and stuff work, I was like, that's the Riddler. And, you know, that's always the association I made.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting that you say that, because I think also with Dan and I, part of our creative collaboration is that we would surprise each other. Like we would sort of bring things to the table and we wouldn't necessarily say where it came from, where the idea came from. And it's like either the other person likes it or not. You know, you sort of judge the idea just on its own merit. And what I remember is that Dan was the one that came up with the knock knock thing. It was sort of like one of these, one day he just came to me and he goes, this is the conceit I want to play around with. And I know that he's more of like a comic book guy than I am. And he may have been inspired, you know, and it's sort of one of those things where he brought it to me. I'm like, it's great. And then we take it and run with it.
Now, let's go a little bit away from the actual story in the show, and let's talk a little bit about kind of the creative side and the behind the scenes. And was there anything, you know, anything that kind of sticks in your mind as like an ultimate moment of like, you know, with the cast and kind of while making this show?
I think it was like near the end, like, I mean, every voice record was really fun. I never missed a single one, and I was so excited by them because everyone is so talented. And they would, a lot of times they'd be standing in the same room. It's not always done that way, but it can be really fun when you have a bunch of people in the same room and they're feeding off each other in real time, and almost improvising sometimes. I mean, every now and then it would just sort of like something would get thrown in, and then it's like, keep that, it's great. So I really enjoyed all of them. But I know at the very end, it was, you know, one of those things that gets really emotional where we did realize it was over and we're still recording the last couple. And you know, and we realized that we had really bonded along the way. And, you know, I just remember the Jonathan Tan who played Li Ping, he brought in like these brownies and it was just sort of cute. He just brought, like, he made a box. It was like Li Ping's favorite brownies, and it was this picture of Li Ping on it. It just like, he just put this thing together. It was sort of simple and sweet. And it was just like, it was great that, you know, cause we were always so professional, and it was nice at the end to just kind of like be a little bit more friendly, you know, that it's just like, we really did something special here. Yeah. Quite emotional at the end. I remember there were some tears, the final day of the record, you know, it was, those are some of the things that spring to mind, because a lot of it was, you know, it was so much, right? It was like four seasons, like 105 episodes or something like that. And it was like, I remember the beginning, you know, I remember when people were auditioning to play the parts. And I remember when it was like, you know, you hear so many and then you're like, that is incredible. And you don't even really know why all the time. And then I remember how fun the sessions were. And then I remember the end, which I think is a lot of times how we remember stuff, right? The beginning and the end, and the middle can be kind of a blur.
Much like Lost, which is remembered, you know, maybe not so fondly for the end, but is definitely remembered. Right. It's definitely remembered for the end. I just don't know how fond it is.
Yeah, it's funny because I always liked the end, because I knew, like, when I was watching it, I was like, oh, man, they're they're trying to answer all the biggest questions about life and existence. I'm like, good luck with that. That's gonna be tough. And I actually found the ending really, really lovely and transcendent. But I mean, I talked to so many people that were furious about it. So, yeah, it's up for grabs.
So I want to talk a little bit about kind of continuity in shows, because I think, like, every time, like, when I was watching the show again, I was like, this, like, there's, like you're saying, like, there's so many things about this that are incredible, right? There is this element of continuity and kind of organization throughout the show. And you watch a lot of shows now, and it feels like you don't, even movie series, like, you don't get that same level of continuity. In your own mind, what do you think has kind of changed where you don't see the same level of continuity throughout a show or throughout a run of a show like you did with, you know, a lot of the early cartoons, especially Detention Air?
So you were saying, like, your point of view is that you're not seeing that as much now with cartoons?
Well, not just cartoons. I think general TV shows, like, I don't think you get that same... A lot of TV shows don't get that same level of continuity and organization kind of that it feels like Detention Air had.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of like it's a risk because once you start going down that road, there is a pressure to tie everything together. And I think a lot of times things change, maybe you lose a cast member and, you know, it's you have to be careful with that in a sense. And I do, it's like, I watch a lot of shows that are sort of like, there's this really new thing where it's like a show will just be like 8 episodes and that'll be it. And it's a lot easier to kind of go, okay, here's what we want to do and sort of plot it all out and then make sure everything ties together. But when you're doing multiple seasons, I think maybe it's easier to just kind of be a bit more freewheeling. And maybe there's more of an appetite for it too. Maybe that is the distinction, is that if you're going to go on and on, it's sort of like sky's the limit. Let's just do anything and have the episodes be able to play out of order. And you can just turn one on at some point. It doesn't really matter where in the story it is. But if you want to watch something with a bit more investment, yeah, maybe you go towards these shorter like mini series and things like that. I mean, that's the thing, is I think I've always loved that. So right now it's like all the shows I'm watching are small, you know, it's like I can binge them in a week or whatever. It's like, 'cause I like that. I like to have it all tied together.
Did you guys face any of that, you know, losing cast members or potentially losing cast members? And how did you kind of deal with that?
No, thankfully we didn't. I don't think we even had too many complications. Like, we were working with really talented people, so it was always a little bit scary that we would, you know, lose them or they wouldn't be available. But we managed to work with their schedules, and there were times where, you know, we would get people in the same room, and sometimes we'd have to bring someone in just for one session just by themselves. I think we even did a few early days of kind of like remote recording, you know, where someone would be down in LA and they would do their record there. It wasn't done that much at the time, but it was kind of early days, where I think it's much more common now. Yeah, I think the biggest one, the I remember early on when we were doing our pilot, we thought we had somebody for Lee Ping, and it was like, we just felt he was so perfect. And I know that he got this offer to go on a Disney cruise to like be a performer on a Disney cruise, and he was gone. It was like, we tried to talk him out of it. We were like, you know, this show could go on for a long time. I know we're just doing the pilot at first, but if it gets picked up for more, this could be going on and on. And, you know, I went as far as saying, you are Lee Ping. I mean, ultimately he was like, you know, want to go work with Disney, and it's a great opportunity. But then we auditioned some more, and then we found Jonathan Tan. And I mean, it's just one of those things, like, we were just blown away by him. And he had a completely different quality. And, you know, and then it's like, then he became Lee Ping, and there was never any, you know, looking back. But I remember at the time being pretty worried, because things were going so well. And it was like, I really felt like an early setback. I was like, oh no. We listened to so many people, and this guy was perfect. But then we found somebody that was perfect in a different way.
That's interesting, because I think when you see shows in general, animated shows, obviously not an exception to that, when you see shows that do really well, right, the people in those shows become a lot more in demand, and then you get worried, okay, are these people going to end up, you know, not having time? You see this like you were saying, all the time with shows where they have to write out characters because the actor just becomes busy or they have to reduce a role, right? How do you think that's kind of changed the way that people write characters where you're like, well, if this person becomes big, we might have to write them out. We might have to kind of do something. Do you think that's changed the way they write shows or is it kind of just stayed the same?
Yeah, I mean, one of the scariest things, and it's to consider and it's dark, is like sometimes if you have an older character, right, it's pretty terrifying because you're just like, what if, God forbid, something was to happen to this person because they're not young. They're pretty up there. And if this is a hit show and it keeps going and going, like, what do you do? I know that that's, you know, it's just, it comes up every once in a while and it's something to consider. And I think that, you know, when like in the early days of prestige television, I think like these, you know, shows like The Sopranos became like these monster hits. And what I think, you know, I think was happening is as the show would continue that the cast would demand more and more money. To the point where it was just like they, you know, it was like, you know, not sustainable. And I wonder, I don't know all the, you know, a lot of the stuff at a really high level of business, but I did wonder whether some of these streamers, I know there was a thing where streamers were like, we're not going to do more than two seasons. And it, I always wondered whether it was that they were like, we're not playing that game. You know, it's like, we're not going to just have people ask for more and more and more money every year. Everyone's doing that. And so we're going to put a cap on it. So it's like, you know, it may take that long to even discover that you have a hit, but then that's it. It's done. So I don't know. It's, those are some of the things that occur to me.
Yeah. I remember Cheers. It happened with Coach, you know, it happened. He obviously died in the middle of the show and it was unfortunate and they had to kind of pivot around that. So, you know, it does happen. Like you're saying, now, with that being said, I know that you're very busy and you've got a lot of stuff going on, but I want to thank you for joining me because this was an amazing conversation. We talked about so much and hopefully everyone listening got a lot out of this and I definitely did. And I want to thank you again for your time. It was really great to have you on. I'm so glad we could kind of work this out and we could kind of talk about the show that I love so much. And I think there's a lot of people who do love it so much now as well.
I thank you. It's an honor to be able to talk to you about it. And it's so interesting how you know the show so well and you know so much about, you know, TV in general and pop culture. And, you know, it's like, I've never really had a conversation like this about the show. So I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much again. We'll have to have you back on at some point, I'm sure, because you're still so busy and so active and, you know, I've scrolled through your Twitter. You love movies. So, I mean, you know, there's always things to talk about with movies. So thank you so much again. And
for sure. Anytime.
Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.